Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guests tonight are returning Marissa Ann Bass. She's professor of Northern European Art, 1400 to 1700, in the History of Art Department at Yale University, and an affiliate of Yale's program in the History of Science and Medicine. Joining her will be Hanneke Grotenboer, professor of the History of Art and chair of the History of the Art Department at Radboud University, Nijmegen. And we're going to be talking about the book. It's a gorgeous volume, Conchophilia, Shells, Art, and Curiosity in Early Modern Europe. Hanneke.
Yes.
Marissa, welcome to the show. Marissa, welcome back to the show. We've talked several times before.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's great to be back. Thank you for having me.
I have to say, you people have really done yourself well this book. You continue to make art books that I wish I was working on that project. This is a stunningly beautiful art book. The reproductions of the paintings are top-notch, but the essays are really, really fascinating. Now, I read at the end that this book began over a borel. Explain that to me.
I'm going to let Hanneke explain that because it's a Dutch tradition.
We all four of us, the four co-authors with Claudia Swan and Goldkar and Marissa and me, we were at the Netherlandish Institute for Advanced Studies in Amsterdam. We all happened to be there in the same year, and we had fantastic and lively conversations because of our shared field. And at one evening, we went to a pub. It's called the Engelbewaarder. It's a very well-known pub in Amsterdam. And it's just across the street from the Center for Advanced Studies. And we, in our conversation, it just turned out that we all had a shared interest in shells and in early modern shell collection. And so we said, let's do a panel. And we did a panel. And I think it was Marissa who immediately said we should call it Conchophilia. And then it turned into this great book.
You still haven't explained what a borel is.
A borel. Oh, sorry, a borel.
It's a cocktail hour, sorry.
Okay. Now,
I think the word borel really sums it up because there's a kind of, you know, everydayness to the borel. It's not a fancy cocktail hour. You can just
so
have
it's beer.
Beer.
It's beer. Beer. Okay.
Yeah.
So basically, you're getting toasted and you decided to come up with the idea for this book. And that is explained because conchophilia, according to the introduction in this book, is not really a word. And I find that hard to believe.
Well, Anne Goldgar, who's our co-author who wrote the introduction, has this, you know, her first word in the introduction, sentence in the introduction, conchophilia ought to be a word, but it isn't.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I said the word, I was like, you know, when we were talking about it, I was like, I'm sure this is a word.
But
looked, and it is not on the interweb anywhere.
But what do they call people who have a passionate for shells? That's got to be
the people who are passionate about shells. I mean,
that's got to be the word.
People probably have used the word, but it is in no dictionary.
Wow. Well, it's got to be a word now because it's on the cover of a book. Now, this is a book that's not. It's about the shells, but it's about the whole cultural symbolism and ideas about the shells. And each essay is very, very, very varied. And shells have fascinated people since the beginning of time because they come from the ocean. I think that's always fascinated people. But in the case of the Low Countries, as trade increased, especially in the 1600s, that was very connected with conchophilia at that time. Explain why.
Marissa, would you like to start?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, the subtitle of the book is, you know, Shells, Art, and Curiosity in the Early Modern World. And by early modern Europe, early modern is important because the sort of heartland of the book is the 17th century. So we cover the 16th century and the 18th century, but the 17th century, exactly as you said, Mark, global trade really takes off both in the Netherlands but also in all of Europe. So we get the sense of an interconnected globe as had never existed before, that it really makes this moment an early modern moment, one that anticipates and echoes the world we now live in. And so the impact for shells and the love of shells is enormous because, of course, some of the most exotic, unusual shells do not come from European shores. In fact, as you look at the images in the book, which are, as you say, stunning and diverse, and the objects as well, the majority of these shells are not coming, are not local finds. They're coming from elsewhere. So there's an entire sort of economic and cultural history, also a history of colonialization that the book addresses.
That's right.
That is wrapped up in the way that these objects were valued in the 17th century in particular.
There was a tremendous interest in shells, and for several reasons, and let's address each one as we go along. First of all, shells are very sensual. And explain why for people who are, I guess, landbound. If you've never seen a lot of these large shells, they're very sensual. You can pick them up. You can touch them. They're very smooth in areas, very rough in other areas. They have different kinds of weights. There was a lot of valuing at that time of the rarity and the variety of these. And is it safe to say that they were considered a work of art by the collectors?
Yeah, that's, I think that is very well put, Mark. Shells were very sensuous and were also experienced as very sensual. If you look at some of the images in the book, people are holding the shells. They are even listening in order to see, to hear the sounds of the ocean. And they could even like taste them or smell them. And they were extremely sensual in that respect. And what they actually did and what they still do, I think, to a certain extent, even in our time, is they evoke a wonder. It is kind of an amazement about how this is made. And they didn't know, most people in the 17th century did not know exactly how shells were made or how they came about. They were initially also not interested in the little slimy animal living within it. They were only interested in this exterior, this wonderful vessel that they could basically fill with salt. One of the appeals, I think, of shells is that you could compare specimens and you could exchange them, you could hand them over. And one other appeal that is also mentioned in Anne Goldcart's introduction is the rivalry between the different collectors.
Oh, yeah.
Of entire collections. But they just wanted to have, they wanted to possess certain specimens that were rare or unique or in other ways interesting. And they just wanted to have the same things, the same items as their fellow collectors had.
One of the things at this time period is that this, as organizations like the Dutch East India Company and other ones that are sending out colonial feelers all over the world, and bringing back things like these shells, is that they considered them an example of the beauty and variety of God's creation. That's how they thought about them, right?
Definitely. And I, you know, the both they're objects of divine creation, but also objects of that are, you know, in ways that many of these collectors that Hanako was just talking about maybe didn't even understand, they are also objects of human manufacture before they were ever turned into drinking goblets or, you know, objects to be represented in paintings or put into cabinets by collectors. Our co-author Claudia Swan in her essay talks about how, you know, this particular naturalist curious, very eager person named Georg Rumpius, who was stationed in what is now Indonesia, and was involved in the elaborate process of preparing shells to look like these beautiful, pristine, pearly specimens.
It was a whole process divine. That she talks about in
absolutely.
That essay.
Acid bath.
Yeah, they don't just pick them up off the beach and then send them to the Netherlands. They're going through this huge process so that they have the right kind of luster,
exactly.
The right kind of surface texture and stuff like that. But as you also mentioned, shells were also put into human-made, very ornate objects, like especially nautilus shells and drinking vessels.
Mm-hmm. And our one of our contributors, and I should say the book has, you know, three contributors who were integral to the success of the book, Anna Graskamp, whose essay is all about these shell cups and their sensual even erotic nature of handling them. Roisin Watson, who has an incredible essay on shell grottos and the kind of where this idea of them as specimens of divine creation really comes into play, because she talks about how an entire cave that was encrusted with shells through elaborate architectural sculptural preparation became a space for contemplating the divine.
This brings up a thing that I want to talk to Hanukkah about, because in her essay, which we'll talk about in more detail in just a bit, and maybe all of you came up with this, but the idea of thinking as these as objects, quote, to think with. And Hanukkah, can you elaborate on that?
Definitely. Yes, I think shells primarily, in the first instance, because of the wonder they evoked thoughts and trains of thought. And that is why also there was discourse around them and discussion around them. So people were trying to figure out what they were doing to you. They were trying to understand the variety. They wanted to order them in particular systems, also, of course, also for decoration quite often, but also to understand them better. And it is said that probably Erasmus, the great Dutch scholar, that he was one of the first who had at least a kind of a small-scale shell collection. So he was fascinated with these objects as well.
Would you use these as objects, and then, like, you would pick them up and then turn them in your hand and then actually use them as focal points of contemplation?
Yeah, I think they do. It's a great painting that is mentioned in Claudia Swann's essay of a collector, Jan Govert van der Aar, who held up one of his great specimen that he is most proud of, apparently. There were very wealthy people who had large collections set in entire rooms within their houses. But most people had kind of smaller collections, sometimes in small table-like cabinets. And most people had at least a few. So that tells us how wide their appeal were. They were also available at boutiques, at exotica boutiques, and primarily in the second half of the century in Amsterdam. There were several of those boutiques. You could just go in there and find yourself an exotic shell.
The one that he was picking up, I think, was the Turbo Mammaratus. Is that the
one?
Exactly
right.
That shows up in a number of paintings. It has to be a very prized species.
Exactly. There were the Nautilus, the Turbo Mammaratus, the Conus Marmoreus, which is famous from Rembrandt's etching, which is the topic of Stephanie Dickey's essay.
That's an essay that compares shell collecting to print collecting.
Exactly. But there were particular shells that, you know, keep popping up because they were particularly prized. They had a particular resonance because of their rarity, their beauty, their luster, all of these qualities that link them both to the divine and also the world of, you know, the world of art and commodity.
Yeah. We're going to have to just briefly talk about each of these essays, or we're going to run out of time. I want to talk about Hanukkah's essay, which is about this dollhouse, Petronella Ortmann's dollhouse, which has a cabinet in it that has a miniature shell collection made of real shells.
Yes, that's right.
I find that amazing.
That is amazing, but it's not as amazing as we think now, because as I just mentioned, most people in the 17th century, merchants, had small or larger shell collections in their houses. So it actually does not come as a surprise that in those houses, and I should say a little bit about that, those houses were fashionable among wealthy women primarily, and they were a way for women to have access to create a collection of their own. So those houses were both images of domestic space, but they were also seen as a collection of very precious objects, and of course objects that were, even though they look like kind of ordinary daily life objects, they were still very precious because they had to be made by real masters and craftsmen. And they had to be made in miniature, which was, of course, a real challenge. And those objects were also seen as objects of wonder. It was, people were amazed about the craftsmanship and the technology of it. So it is no surprise that in a doll's house that probably very much resembled Petronella Ortmann's actual residence in the Warmoestraat in Amsterdam, that in that dollhouse we would find an art cabinet filled with shelves. What is interesting, however, and what is very special about Petronella's shell collection is that it is a miniature shell collection, and that in comparison to all the other 700 objects that were made specifically for her doll's house, the shells are the only objects that are not handmade.
They're actual real, and they were collected miniature specimens.
They were actual real and miniature specimen. And there were, of course, there was another kind of a kind of sad touch to them, because they are not miniaturized shells. They are not miniature versions of larger shells. These are baby shells.
That's right.
The life of these little mollusks was nipped in the bud, and that is why they ended up in miniature shape. So they're premature. Their death was premature.
You write about these dollhouses as being female counterparts of the cabinets of curiosities that were very male spaces. These dollhouses were specifically female spaces, and it's really fascinating. There's the inclusion of a lying-in room, and you have to explain what that is in these dollhouses.
Yeah, specific for Dutch dollhouses were actually two things. The fact that the dolls, in comparison to German or French or English dollhouses were in fashion in the early modern period. And the specific, the interesting difference between Dutch dollhouses and other European dollhouses was that they would stand most of the times they would stand on legs and they would have doors. So it was more like a doll's cabinet than a doll's house. So you could look into it as if in a regular cabinet of curiosities. The most of the Dutch dollhouses were kept by women, and exclusively, actually, so, and they all had a lying-in room in addition to a nursery. If we look at German dolls houses, most of them have a nursery there, but the Dutch dolls houses have quite often, in addition to a nursery, a laying-in room. The laying-in room is the place where women would give birth and where they would stay for at least 6 weeks after the birth of their child. It was a space. Of course, this is of course only for people wealthy circles. This was a space that was specifically arranged for birth and the period afterwards. And there was a space also in which people were received who wanted to congratulate the new mother. Now, this was specific also for the Netherlands because children had a particular position in Dutch households, because since the Netherlands was a republic at the time, houses and good housekeeping was very important, was seen as a metaphor for a good kind of more national economy. And houses of merchants were then, of course, seen as a nursery for the new leaders of the republic. So giving birth to children and raising children was very important. You see that in representations constantly confirmed.
I have to mention there's a series of paintings that are included of this dollhouse by Jacob Appel.
That's correct.
And it's as if they were filled with people.
They were. The Petronella Ortmann's dollhouse is a unique case, because all the objects that were in there that she has commissioned and that were in there in the 17th century are still in there today.
Wow.
Except for the 25 waxen dolls that were dressed to the nines and that were put in the different rooms in the doll's house, and enacting various scenes. and scenes that we recognize from, for instance, from genre scenes in Dutch 7th century painting. So the doll's house was inhabited, but no longer. And maybe interesting to note, just because of the laying in room that we've just discussed, the only waxen doll that survived is the little baby doll. So that's the only one that is still there in the Rijksmuseum collection.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guests tonight are Marissa Ann Bass, professor of Northern European art in the history of art department at the Yale University and an affiliate of the Yale's program in the history of science and medicine, and Hanneke Grotenboer, professor of the history of art and chair of the history of art department at Radboud University, Nijmegen. Marissa, I got to talk to you about your essay because I want to make sure I spend time talking about that. You talk about shells in still life and how unstill they are. You talk about shell life versus still life. You got to explain that.
Sure, Mark. Well, I mean, I should say Hanneke and I, our essays share a subsection of the book called Microworlds of Thought. And we came up with that title because there's a really, I think, close link, even though we're dealing with very different material, between Hanneke's essay and my own, in that we're both thinking about what shells do in the space of a dollhouse or a painting, and what is unique about what shells do. Because, you know, I think, you know, thinking back to this whole book, you know, like, conchophilia seems like a niche topic, right? But one of the amazing things that we discovered over the process of writing this book is that shells are not only everywhere. Like, we just kept finding shells. We were sending constant emails. Look at this crazy shell we found. But also, they're connected to everything, to every, you know, aspects of culture, politics, religion, things we've already discussed in this interview already. And so my question was really, okay, so what does a shell do that's different in a painting than other things? Mm. So if you think about the genre of still life painting, you know, so many things end up in early modern still life painting that we're familiar with: flowers, fruits, you know, luxury goblets, you know, luxury objects, foodstuffs of all sorts. So what's different about shells? And what's different about shells, you know, is, you know, precisely as Hanneke was talking about earlier, is that shells are, you know, they are things that we know. They come from the sea, that they were once inhabited by, you know, living creatures. And what we get is the remainder, you know, this thing, but that this remainder that is in a way like the skeleton of a shell. And yet they are so alive to us because of their colors and their shapes and their variety, because you can turn them around in the hand and contemplate them. And so they are very liminal objects. And so when a shell is in a picture, it's such a great opportunity for an early modern artist. And, of course, still life in the early modern period, I mean, it was already a paradoxical name. It was all about this idea of, well, how can painting bring something to life, make something move that is still, you know? How can it do something that reality can't do? And so you put a shell in a picture, and it almost doubles that kind of game, right? It's like, how can you bring to life this thing that was once in this ocean, deep down beneath the sea, in this place we can't access? And so I sort of try to explore through different genres of painting, including not only still life, but also a mythological painting.
Oh, that's a what? That's
crazy painting.
That's a crazy painting. That's Perseus in Andromeda.
Exactly.
Oh my God! And she's walking on shells and skulls.
Yes, I mean, yeah, that painting really—you have to see it to believe it. It's a painting in the Louvre in Paris, and you know, she's standing there naked, extremely sensual, towing this very luscious conch shell that's turned, its peachy inside is turned towards you, and then it's surrounded by this other carpet of other shells, human remains, and then you see the dragon that Perseus is, you know, about to slay in the distance, you know, which is presumably the source of much of this carnage. But, you know, that really drives home the connection between sort of shells and death and the kind of deep darkness of the sea. But then there are other paintings that bring out the idea of shells as a form of architecture,
right.
That they are, you know, they are also the dwelling spaces. And this, again, it resonates with how Haneke talks about the shell as a sort of as a home for the thought of these women collectors making these incredible dollhouses in the Dutch Republic. So that these are, you know, were inhabited by creatures that we now know were often, you know, the Conus marmoreus, for instance, was inhabited by an extremely toxic creature that would have been, you know, perilous to human touch. And yet these objects were being, you know, touched and handled by collectors in the 17th century who were blissfully unaware of that fact because they'd never come into contact with the living thing itself. So that's really what I use the idea of shell life. And I think in many ways that idea resonates with much else that's in the book, because we really are talking about how the life of shells intersects with the life of the people who they fascinated.
We're almost out of time. There's a great painting by Balthazar van der Arst. It's a still life with fruit and flowers. And it's got all these shells in the foreground. But one of them has got a hermit crab in it. So he's found a way to, like, animate the shell in this still life.
Exactly. And I love that hermit crab. It was a motif that van der Arst used in several of his still lifes, because it also talks about the shell as it's an object that can be reappropriated, right?
That's right. The hermit crab
didn't make that shell. He just took it over. And now he's crawling out of the space of the shell in this picture, sort of disrupting what seems like a very serene, on the surface very static, representation of a table, you know, laid out with exotic shells and flowers and porcelain and fruit, and just saying, look at me, here I am. You know, this shell can be mine too.
And thinking of these as objects to think with, to contemplate with, it's amazing. Jacques Lenard's painting, Still Life with Shells and Coral. The coral looks like an aorta. I mean, it looks like part of the heart. It's this brilliant, crazy red color. And the shells, as you write in the essay, are from South America and the Eastern Atlantic. So for the people looking at the paintings or holding the shells in real life, these really represent global sort of conquest by the Low Countries. Right? Hello?
Yes.
Okay.
No, that's correct. But and the painting is on the cover. But that's a painting that Marissa discusses in her essay. So I wanted her to have a chance to say something about it. But that's right.
We're also completely out of time, and we've only started to talk about all the essays in this book. My guests tonight have been Marissa Ann Bass, professor of Northern European art in the History of Art Department at Yale University, and an affiliate of Yale's program in the History of Science and Medicine, and also Haneke Grootenboer, I hope I pronounced that right, Grootenboer, professor of the history of art and chair of the history of art department at Radboud University at Nijmegen. And we've been talking about their book. It's just an amazing book, both to read and to just sit there and soak in the paintings. Conchophilia, Shells, Art, and Curiosity in Early Modern Europe. Marissa and Haneke, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good evening.